If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello. So you are still speaking to me then?
Why is that?
Well, I'm going to let the listeners into a little something that happened.
Yeah.
Ed, last weekend, decided to cook a black bean soup.
I did, and it was on Saturday morning last weekend.
And you sent me a photograph of it. You're quite proud.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was very nice about the photograph.
I think you were at the top end of reactions to the black bean soup, in truth.
Oh, really? I said it looked like a ditch after a storm.
Can I tell you the story? I mean, this bloody black bean soup. So I bought the black beans more than a year ago.
Were they in your Brexit cupboard?
Yeah. So I think I've had black bean soup in a Mexican restaurant before, and I quite like Mexican food. So then, totally uncharacteristically, last weekend, partly to sort of keep the demons at bay, I decided to start cooking at like Saturday morning at 10 a.m. And I decided to cook this black bean soup, and I'd ordered the soured cream that you can have in the black bean soup and all that. I mean, it's a bit of a bugger to make, and I only realised afterwards that if you've got, it's so weird this, if there's hard water in the place you live, you shouldn't put the red wine in early because it makes it much harder to break down the beans. So I then had to sort of blend the beans to sort of release the starch, break them down. Anyway, I sort of eventually got to the end of the black bean soup, made it. I mean, Justine had always been expressing sort of relative sort of distaste for the idea of this black bean soup, but I persisted. I sent the video, the picture to you. You were pretty contemptuous. I got her to eat some for lunch, and she wasn't really having any of it. So the black bean soup then sat in the fridge for 3 days, and I've now frozen it because I thought I can't throw it out. So I put it in Tupperware and frozen it. Now, I don't know what my next step is on the black bean soup. I mean, I actually thought the black bean soup was perfectly nice, but I suppose I then realised that black bean soup, you can only have it in small doses, really.
See, I wondered if the problem might be that the photograph you took, you hadn't styled the food properly, because there is an art to food photography.
I mean, will you at some point, when lockdown is over, have some of this black bean soup? I mean, I actually think it is perfectly edible, the black bean soup.
But you've got to learn to take better pictures of your food. Do you know there are people whose job it is on photo shoots to make food?
I'm not sure the problem was the picture.
Let me give you some items used in food photo shoots, and you can try and guess what they're used for. Motor oil.
I don't know.
That is, if you're ever taking a picture of a stack of pancakes with syrup on them, you don't use real syrup because it soaks into the pancakes too quickly. So if you pour Castrol GTX or whatever...
Is that true?
Yeah. Glue.
I have no idea.
Glue, if you want to take a photograph of a bowl of cereal, but you don't want the milk to make the cereal go soggy, you use, you know, like glue in there. I'm guessing like craft glue, like kids use.
Wow.
And it looks like milk on camera.
Not Pritt stick, yeah.
Shaving cream?
No idea.
It's an easy one. Whipped cream.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then what, I'll give you a guess at this one.
Yeah.
In food photo shoots, what are tampons used for? You soak them in water and then you microwave them and hide them in the photo so to give the impression of steam coming off the food.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Is that you? That's how did you find this out?
Did a bit of helpful Googling beforehand. So the next time you're sending me a picture of your black bean soup, you just need to soak some tampons in water and hide them somewhere in the photo.
I'm not sure the steam would have helped very much, though.
Maybe not.
Anyway, for my next trick, I'm making a tofu recipe this weekend. I'm not giving up. But I mean, I think the problem is, I think there's a sort of category error that I made, which is I'm not sure that people like black bean soup that much.
I like a black bean soup.
Do you?
Yeah. Good way of getting a bit of protein as a vegetarian.
Yeah, that's the other thing is that, I mean, it was alleged that it had funny sort of stomach effects. The black bean soup. Anyway.
Well, I look forward to hearing about the tofu next week then.
Yeah.
Should we talk about what we're talking about on this week's episode then?
This week we're talking about childcare and the impact of the last few months on working parents. Lockdown has reminded us how much we rely on childcare, as many of us have had to juggle looking after kids at home alongside doing our usual jobs. Now, research has shown this has had a disproportionate impact on working mothers. One study found 70% of mothers said they were the default parent during lockdown. Another found mothers have done an average of 2 hours more childcare a day than fathers. With the earlier childcare sector now in crisis as a result of coronavirus and a quarter of providers at risk of collapse, we're asking how to make sure childcare is truly valued in the coronavirus recovery. We're talking to researcher Christine Berry and Lucy Stevens from the New Economics Foundation about why the crisis should prompt a re-evaluation of our approach to both paid and unpaid childcare. And we're talking to Marianne Stevenson from the Women's Budget Group about the broader economic impact of the crisis on working women and the need for government to consider gender equality in the recovery.
And I'm very excited about this week's cheerful person. He was actually my reason to be cheerful a few weeks ago. He has been a boon to parents of young children during lockdown. He is the host of the podcast, his podcast, on CBeebies. It's Nick Cope.
Looking forward to that conversation. And spoiler alert, there's some singing.
That's right.
Not by us, though. That would be indeed a spoiler. So what's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful this week is that our local playground has reopened.
Hurrah!
So my son has somewhere to go.
Not yet the leisure centre.
Well, listen to this. It was due to reopen last Saturday. So I wasn't there, but all these parents converged on the park. It wasn't open because the council hadn't done all the necessary...
The playground, not the leisure centre.
The playground. The council hadn't done all the necessary safety checks. So the parents, it was like the storming of the Bastille. They broke the gate down.
Oh my gosh.
It's Clissold Park in Stoke Newington in North London. And maybe they didn't break the gate down, but they certainly they bent the bars and all these people were sort of rampaging and storming the playground.
Has it been a local news story?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you weren't one of the guilty.
No, and I'm a rule follower to the extent that the next day we were in there and there were all these kids and parents climbing through the railings, through the gap in the railings, because it was padlocked up and my son wanted to go in and I said, no, absolutely not. Those people are rule breakers. We are rule followers in this family.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Well, I'm glad to know you're a rule follower. Yeah. But I mean, the fact that it's officially reopening is good.
Yes. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is a film. And honestly, this film is like bloody good. It's called A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood. And it's with Tom Hanks. What kind of O was that?
No, I know about Mr. Rogers because I'm married to an American. I've never heard of him.
Honestly, you are going to be... I mean, honestly, if I was weeping, I mean, you are just going to be weeping absolute buckets. I mean, you're going to need, like, you know, a couple of buckets.
I think there was a really good documentary about him that was released in cinemas a few years ago. And off the back of
they decided to
make this biopic.
But the thing was, I don't know whether I talked to you about this at the time, but there was this amazing New York Times article about a woman who went to interview Tom Hanks about the film last November. And I remember reading it at the time and feeling incredibly moved by the article because she breaks down or bursts into tears during the interview with Tom Hanks. And basically Tom Hanks comes across as literally the nicest man in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the whole article is about what a nice man Tom Hanks is, and he's incredibly nice to her. And then I read that article and I'd forgotten about the film until we came across it. And then the film is honestly made by Tom Hanks was for some reason nominated for Best Supporting Actor, didn't win the Oscars. But honestly, the film is made by Tom Hanks. And just, you might think this is a film about a children's TV character. You know, it could be about Rent-A-Ghost or something. But it's really about sort of kindness and talking to your children about their feelings. And, I mean, it is really, I mean, honestly, it's a really, really good. And there's this incredibly sort of resonant thing that I read in this New York Times interview, which is, it's basically about a journalist who is sort of kind of, well, in the film, an investigative journalist who writes nasty things about people. And it's based on a true story. And he basically has his sort of life and his kind of mind changed by Mr. Rogers. But there's something in the journalist who I think wrote the book or the piece about Mr. Rogers said something like, in the end, I concluded it wasn't about who the real Mr. Rogers was. It was what he did. It's what you do, not who you are, that matters. In other words, what you do tells you who you are. And basically the point was, Mr. Rogers was such a kind person that told you who he was. And so therefore, searching for who the real Mr. Rogers was wasn't really the point. You just needed to look at what he was really like and what he really did for people. And I thought it was a really interesting life lesson.
Yeah, can't wait to watch that and have a good cry.
Honestly, this film is bloody amazing.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're going to start by talking to Christine Berry, who's making a second appearance on the podcast, who's a freelance researcher and writer, and Lucy Stevens, who is head of co-production at the New Economics Foundation. Hello, both. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. And Christine, if we could start with you. You've been talking to parents about childcare during lockdown, and I was wondering if you could tell us, from the conversations that you've been having, what has the experience of the last few months been like?
I think if I had to sum it up in a word, exhausting. I think the commonality to, you know, almost all parents, certainly working parents through the crisis, has been having to juggle work with childcare. So there's been this weird disjunct where anyone without children, you know, was wondering how they were going to fill this vast expanse of time ahead of them, and talking about the new hobbies they were going to take up, being worried about loneliness. For parents, it's been the complete opposite experience, right? Because with schools and with nurseries closed, they're basically being expected to do two jobs at once. So to homeschool or look after their toddlers or babies, and to carry on with their day jobs. And I think I really can't overstate just the level of financial and mental and emotional strain that's put on families. The impact of that on almost everybody that I know and everyone I've spoken to has been just absolutely immense. But I think it's also really important to recognise that, as with everything in this crisis, the impacts of that have not been spread evenly, right? And, you know, there are obvious gender disparities in who's picking up that childcare, but also massive differences in terms of class and what type of employment you're in. So even in the best case scenario, a lot of, you know, middle class, securely employed parents that I know, whose employers have been quite understanding and basically said, you know, just do your best. We understand you won't be able to keep working all of your hours. Even they've ended up deciding they need to cut their hours because they just can't cope, and they've taken a pay cut as a result of that. But then at the other end of the scale, you know, I've heard some like truly horrendous stories of parents, even with kids with special educational needs or kids that have got health conditions that have been told they should be shielding, where their employers have refused them furlough and basically told them they need to come into work or they're going to be fired. People who've lost their jobs, you know, people who for that reason have had to rely on grandparents for care when they weren't supposed to during lockdown, and have had police knocking on their door threatening to fine them because their grandparents have been around. So I think the position that some people have been put in by that is just, you know, truly kind of impossible and intolerable.
And what do you think about how lockdown and this past period has what do you think it's shown up about our reliance on childcare, about holes in the system, about how it's valued or perhaps not valued?
Yeah, I mean, it's been this sort of weirdly contradictory thing, I think, the experience of childcare in lockdown, that on the one hand, you know, we've seen this tacit acknowledgement that childcare is essential, right? So that was a big feature of the debate about schools reopening, was that everyone sort of knew that the reason government was pushing so hard for schools to reopen was because they wanted to get parents back to work, and parents couldn't go back to work whilst looking after their children. But on the other hand, I think government hasn't wanted to make that explicit or to kind of explicitly value and acknowledge that unpaid childcare work. I think partly because the scale of it is just so immense that they don't want to open that Pandora's box because they don't want to assume those liabilities.
Lucy, can we bring you in here and you know, just to speak a bit more to what Christine was just saying. Talk to us a little bit, I guess, about perhaps how the state and policy have approached childcare in the past and what the last few months have done to maybe cause us to reevaluate that.
I mean, I would echo a lot of what Christine's saying. In the parents that I'm speaking to, childcare is almost the only conversation that's going on. But I'd say at a policy level, across all parties, there's a deafening silence about childcare at the moment. We can't be talking about jobs without being conscious of and talking about childcare and how to fix the problem that we've got. Childcare, I guess, like many things, that the term Build Back Better is really important. Childcare was broken before the crisis. It was very, very fragile. We were seeing extensive numbers of closures. A lot of families, and many of those actually the key worker families who played such a critical role in recent months, already probably experienced that feeling that many of us are now experiencing in terms of being locked out of childcare. If you work irregular hours or long shifts, if you have very limited income coming in, it is very hard already to find childcare places. If you have children with special educational needs, it is very difficult to find childcare places. So to some extent, the rest of us are perhaps experiencing that juggle and that pressure that many households have been under, particularly poorer households, single parent families, people on low incomes, for a long time. So perhaps it's slightly kind of waking the rest of us up to the pressures that entails.
So, Lucy, just for people who don't necessarily know the answer to this, what schools are due to reopen in September. Talk to us about what is likely to happen in the childcare sector and the scale of the, just summarise if you can, the scale of the crisis facing the sector.
So, as I was saying, childcare has been fragile before the sector. Many providers feel very much starved of cash, so no one's got any savings to help kind of cover. And the financial pressure that they're under now is significant. So recent surveys done by the Early Years Alliance are suggesting that 1 in 4 settings will be closed for good by Christmas. So that could be between 200,000 and 150,000 childcare places lost for good.
Even if they were to sort of reopen?
Yes. Some of the recent polling is showing that less than half of parents who were questioned in June were expecting to take up their places again. There's concerns from parents around the health implications of using nurseries, but also there's big pressure on household income and people's working patterns and their security of work is changing as well. 71% of providers are anticipating they'll be running at a loss for at least the rest of the year. And those settings that are managing to continue are accruing debts, and those debts will need to be paid off in some way. So the risk is even those that make it through are going to have to find a way to repay the debts. And the most likely way to do that will be through increasing fees.
So that's the state of the childcare sector as a result of COVID. And we'll come on to some of the solutions in a second. But I think it would be good if both of you talked about the fact that the experience that families have had of looking after children during this crisis has not fallen in an equal way in gender terms, I think it's fair to say, to put it mildly. Why don't you both talk to this? Christine first, why don't you say something about this?
As is always the case, and again, as with the things that Lucy's been talking about, this is really an exacerbation of things that were present before the crisis, right? It was already the case that the vast majority of unpaid care was done by women, and likewise the vast majority of unpaid care that's been generated by the pandemic has been picked up by women, and that has really huge implications, I think, going forward in terms of widening the career penalty that working mothers already suffer. And again, I think that's the case even in a sort of best case scenario for quite secure, well-off middle-class professional women. So academia is a good example. I think there's been some research done showing that there's a massive disparity in the amount of academic papers being published by women and men during lockdown, for example. And again, kind of that's massively worse for people who are in insecure or low-income work. So I think at the extreme, we could basically be seeing a whole cohort of women starting to be pushed out of the labour market with a disproportionate effect on low-income women or women in deprived areas as well.
And I guess, Lucy, it's shone a light both on the, as Christine implied, the expectations of employers and the very gendered expectations of employers, and also the gendered division of labour in the home, basically. So it's a combination of what happens in the home and what the expectations of employers are.
Yeah, absolutely. So before COVID, the maternal employment rate was at 75%, which is great. I mean, it could be better, but that was really good news. But I think we're going to see some really significant changes. And research coming out of the Fawcett Society already are showing mothers are much more likely than fathers to have either lost their jobs, been furloughed, or quit as a result of COVID. We've got over 4 million mothers in the labour force at the moment who've got children who are under 11 years old. And there was, I think this hits home for me a lot. There was some research from UCL a few weeks ago showing that working mothers have been able to only do 1 hour of uninterrupted paid work for every 3 hours that fathers have managed to do during the lockdown. But then there's also that conversation that goes on in the home, you know, where households are under pressure and economic decisions need to be made. Some of this is cultural. Some of this feels like straight economic sense. But before the crisis, women were particularly overrepresented in part-time work. When it comes to a question of who's going to need to take a break in order that the children can be cared for, it seems like a sensible decision that it's women that are stepping out, but that is going to have short and long-term implications for women's careers, for women's representation, and for household income.
Well, it's really, really important to talk about both sets of issues. Now Neff is calling, Lucy, for a childcare infrastructure fund. Say a bit more about that and say what lessons we can learn from what's happened in other countries during this process.
Yeah, certainly. So there's been a lot of talk of infrastructure recently, but sadly, it's mostly been fluorescent jackets and hard hats. So childcare is a critical social infrastructure. And as I said earlier, we can't talk about jobs without acknowledging that childcare needs to exist in order that people can turn up for those jobs, particularly women, particularly lone parents. So what Neff is proposing is a two-stage response. The first response is actually to acknowledge the enormous crisis that is taking place before our very eyes in the childcare sector. And government needs to move quickly to step in and intervene to shore up the sector in order that they can continue to provide the care that's needed with the flexibility that will be required over the next 6 months. So what we're suggesting is a direct payment to all Ofsted registered providers, and that payment would cover all of the staff salaries and lift those staff salaries up to the real living wage, and then would cover overhead essentials for providers as well. In return for paying that money, providers would be obliged to provide free childcare to all parents, whether they take up their places or not, so ensuring that those places are secured and offering free care to those parents who are using it.
So what would this mean for somebody who currently has a childcare place and then for somebody who wants a childcare place but can't get one?
So at the moment, payment for childcare places is through the incredibly complex system of free hours, which are available to some but not all families and are on the basis of all sorts of different hours. What we're saying is freeze all of that and tax-free childcare payments. Take all of that over and redeploy that to pay directly the cost of providing childcare. So those families who already have a place would no longer be required to make any financial contribution for that place. Essentially, what we're saying is let's move away from an incredibly complex system that is not very efficient in terms of how it invests money. It is hugely bureaucratic for both parents and providers who are using it, and pay the direct costs of providing childcare in the short term, so that we know that those providers have the flexibility that they need.
How does this compare to what's happened in places like Australia and Ireland during this crisis?
Well, the intervention is very much mirrored on what's gone on in Australia and Ireland. In both those countries, they run a similar market-based approach to childcare, and both of them were recognising their sectors were under significant threat of collapse. So driven by a desire both to ensure continuity of care for children and also to avoid the mass redundancies of childcare workers, they stepped in, ensured that key workers got free childcare and that all providers' salary costs and overheads were paid. Because what also has been going on in this country, which we didn't sort of touch on at the beginning, but about 30% of childcare providers during the lockdown have continued to ask parents to make a financial contribution for places that they can't use. Families have been under this real kind of pressure to continue to pay because they're worried if they don't pay, they lose their place, even though they can't use their place at the moment. But if they get asked to go back to work at some point in the future, they won't be able to go back to work if they don't have a place. So there's this huge kind of pushing it back onto households to cover the cost of this, where governments should actually be investing.
So, Christine, beyond this, what should we be looking at, do you think, to address these issues around childcare that we've talked about, how women have been hit so disproportionately by this, about the division of labour in the home, about the way that employers see childcare? What do you think we should be thinking about to improve the situation?
It's funny, we look at the US healthcare system, for example, and we think, well, that's obviously bonkers. It's like one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world. It's fragmented, it's privatized, it's inefficient. Everybody has a universal right to healthcare. Why do you not just provide it publicly? Right. And that seems bonkers to us because we have the NHS. But I think a lot of Europeans would probably look at our childcare system and think exactly the same thing, right? It's one of the most expensive in the world. It's not high quality. That's certainly not because the staff are being paid or treated well, because a lot of childcare workers are on poverty pay or in really insecure employment in terrible conditions. They're not being valued. Their skills and professionalism isn't being recognised. So if we can use this moment where childcare really is facing a crisis that could lead to mass redundancies for childcare workers, women being pushed out of the labour market, nurseries failing, if we can use that as a kind of moment to reimagine the childcare system more fundamentally, to turn it into something that we think about more in the way that we think about education or healthcare, so that it should be provided as a universal right by the state. And I think crucially, better paying conditions for childcare workers needs to be part of that. This is something I actually feel really strongly about. I think at the moment we can be in this what seems like a kind of zero-sum game between the unpaid care of parents who are struggling with unaffordable childcare and childcare workers and nurseries. But the root cause of all of those problems is that we don't value childcare and we don't treat it as a public good. So those paid workers aren't valued, parents' unpaid work isn't valued, and we need to see that in the round and be treating those problems together rather than imagining that there's some kind of trade-off between them.
Can we talk a little bit about what a reimagining of unpaid childcare could look like? How much of a difference would shared parental leave, flexible working, things like this, how much of a difference would they make?
A lot of people don't realise how rubbish our shared parental leave system is, actually. So just as an example, my partner is a very hands-on dad, would have loved to take shared parental leave and basically couldn't because I'm self-employed and shared parental leave is paid at the rate of the mum, basically, not the person who's taking the leave. So if my partner had taken parental leave, he wouldn't have got paid based on his salary. He would have got paid based on my salary, which was basically nothing because I was on statutory maternity. And I think a lot of, because of pre-existing gender inequalities in pay, it just means that it's simply unaffordable for a lot of people to take shared parental leave. So even though it's theoretically there as a legal right, and much was made of the fact that it was introduced, it's just not practical for a lot of families to take it up. And so that is contributing to these continuing massive disparities in unpaid care within the home. And so I think fixing that, and having a genuinely kind of equitable use it or lose it shared parental leave entitlement for non-birth partners paid based on their salary and not their partner's salary, could be potentially quite transformative in terms of fixing some of these disparities.
We're big fans, aren't we, of the... Well, I know latte papa is a bit sort of pejorative, as it's known in Sweden, but we're big fans, aren't we, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked to people in the Nordic countries, and we're in awe of what they're doing over there.
But particularly on this paid paternity leave point, because I think it's so often ignored, use it or lose it, but it's so often sort of not seen as the priority, because I think people underestimate the knock-on implications it can have, the positive knock-on implications it can have.
Absolutely. And I think alongside that, shifting into a system where flexible working is a right for all from the very beginning of work and not seen as kind of part-time as somehow half-assed, you know, we need to be recognising that working flexibly also enables families to balance their wider caring responsibilities.
Christine, do you think a light bulb moment is coming? I know you've written about how the crisis hasn't yet prompted one, but do you think one is on the way? Or
I mean, I hate to be the voice of doom actually here, not doom, but I mean, it is striking given how compelling this conversation is, how little this has been part of the debate, isn't it?
Deafening silence.
Yeah, no, I think totally. So far, it's been really disheartening, actually. I think a lot of people hoped there would be a bit of a light bulb moment once schools and nurseries closed, you know, because we're so dependent on them and so much economic activity would sort of collapse under the strain, that people would start to realise that we couldn't go on like this. But instead, I think what's actually happened is you've seen sort of continuity rather than change, in the sense that that strain has just been absorbed disproportionately by women in the home, just like it was before, and has remained basically invisible to most other people and basically invisible in the political debate.
But okay, but let me ask you this question, Christine. Draw us the line, the narrative line, from the experience of the crisis to the narrative for after the crisis around in this area.
I mean, yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because as we were saying, the impacts are being felt by the people who are directly affected by childcare, so by parents, by childcare workers. They're by and large not really being felt by other people. So for those people, there's an obvious narrative line to say, you know, childcare is a job. You can't do two jobs at once. Looking after a child is work, whether it's, you know, unpaid within the home, whether it's paid in a nursery. Looking after our children, nurturing them, educating them is one of the most fundamental things that we should be supporting as a society. And at the moment, that activity isn't supported, whether it's paid or whether it's unpaid. None of those people are being valued properly. And more generally, we're having this reckoning, right, with the whole concept of key workers and us realizing, you know, who really are the essential workers? What are the activities we can't do without? And it's really glaringly apparent that childcare is one of those activities. I think the problem is that hasn't been brought home in that immediate way to people who don't have children and who aren't directly affected by this. And that's the biggest barrier. But, you know, when I first started writing about this, about childcare during lockdown, I had a guy on Twitter when I posed the rhetorical question, you know, if looking after my child was a full-time job when someone else was doing it, why isn't it a full-time job now that I'm doing it myself? And this random dude on Twitter said, oh, because you chose to have him. And that's how people think about childcare, right? We've got this idea, somehow we've arrived at this idea that having a child is some kind of esoteric lifestyle choice rather than literally the essential reproduction of the human race. And I think that getting over that kind of narrative challenge and saying, actually, no, this is a socially essential function and we need to be supported to do it. I think that's what could be the impetus for real change.
I mean, we should hear from Lucy, but I mean, maybe the other two thoughts are, one, a bit like the social care sector, except maybe less front of mind for obvious reasons, it's revealed the fragility and the sort of underpaid nature of the sector. So what Lucy talked about earlier, you know, that it's such a sort of, you know, bric-a-brac sort of confusing system, the sort of the lack of provision. But also, I think this point about it shone a light on the very gendered nature, as gendered as before, the very gendered nature, or not as gendered as before, but still very gendered nature of who ultimately does the work in the home. Is that right, Lucy?
Absolutely. I guess one of the other bits I'd add in terms of why it's not in front of everyone at the moment is many of us are still working from home. I think when you look at key workers and their experience of the crisis, it's clear that there was a massive issue with childcare, that many settings didn't open, that childcare, that key workers were having to negotiate and find places for their children on top of working extremely long hours and taking big risks with their own health and safety. But these are things that are being documented and are being experienced by individuals across the place. But there's either a willful or unconscious blindness to this, because this is still at points, it feels like this is a household issue. This is the thing that we think about. And my real concern is the tide is in at the moment. You know, we're all locked down still. Most of us haven't been asked to go back to work unless we really, really have to. But as more and more people start trickling back to work, that's when we'll turn around and find that this childcare infrastructure has gone. And that will be too late. And the childcare providers are shouting loudly at the moment and explaining exactly what the future looks like. But they're being treated like businesses and like a marketplace, and that is not what we need for high quality universal care.
I think that's spot on. And I think it was, when you really think about it, it's astonishing that childcare wasn't even mentioned in the mini budget on Wednesday, right? When you think about the direct job creating potential of investing in childcare for a start in a situation where we're facing mass mm-hmm. unemployment, the indirect potential in terms of supporting women's ability to work and to stay and work. We've been talking about gender disparities, but I think that's really reflective of a gender disparity, you know, a deeper gender disparity in the political debate as well, right? That when we think of industrial strategy, we think of men in hard hats and construction, even though actually investing in care will create more jobs. And in many ways is as essential, if not more essential, to our future economic prosperity. And I think that's the argument that we need to be making right now.
Christine Berry and Lucy Stevens, that's been a really brilliant and enlightening conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So we're joined now by Marianne Stevenson, who is director of the Women's Budget Group. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, just for our listeners who may not know, talk to us about the Women's Budget Group and the work you do.
Yeah, so we're a network of academics, women from civil society organisations, the women's voluntary sector, campaigners, policy people, trade unionists, and we analyse the impact of economic policy on women and men in the UK. And we also promote gender responsive budgeting, which is a way of looking at budgets for their gender impact, both in the UK and around the world.
Now we've had a conversation so far with Christine and Lucy about coronavirus, its impact on the childcare providers, but also on women and their role trying to combine working and looking after kids. Talk to us more broadly about the coronavirus crisis and how the Women's Budget Group views its effect on women.
So I suppose the first thing to say is this crisis comes on top of a set of pre-existing inequalities that women experience both in the labour market and in the home. So women are more likely to be low paid, they're more likely to be in insecure work, they're more likely to be on 0 hours contracts. So they're more likely to be in debt, they're more likely to be living in poverty, and they do significantly more unpaid work. And so obviously when you get a crisis like the coronavirus crisis, that comes on top of those pre-existing inequalities. So you've got women were far more likely to be key workers, both in the health and social care sector, but also in food retail, for example. But they were also more likely to work in sectors that were completely locked down. So retail, apart from food, hospitality, travel and tourism and so on. So they were, you know, some groups of women were doing more work than they'd ever had to do before. And other groups of women were unable to work and are now in a situation where they're extremely anxious about whether or not they're going to be made redundant in the next few months as the furlough scheme lifts.
And looking forward, what do you think the long-term impact of this will be? Do you think it'll affect things like the gender pay gap?
Well, I think it's really worrying. As I said, because women are overrepresented in those sectors where there's likely to be high levels of redundancies, I think we are likely to see more women losing their jobs, and women losing their jobs in greater numbers than they did, for example, after the 2008 financial crisis, where it was men initially who lost their jobs. Obviously, women were harder hit by the austerity that came afterwards. So there's that issue. And then there's the issue of childcare. And this is something where I think the government's really not taken sufficient action. You know, most children still haven't returned to school, still didn't return to school this term. We've got the long summer holidays about to start, when a lot of working parents rely on grandparents, family members, friends to provide childcare. Obviously, with social distancing in place, that might not be possible. We're not entirely sure whether schools are going to be back with children in full time in a normal school day. Nurseries still aren't taking new babies. So there's all those barriers as well for women returning to work. So I think it is really worrying looking forward. Turn to Us also did some research. They're a charity that support people in financial need, and they provide advice. And they did some research in about April where they estimated that the gender pay gap was going to increase based on the relative falls that men and women were predicting in their pay as a result of the virus.
So something you advocate for at the Women's Budget Group is gender responsive budgeting, which accounts for these inequalities. Can you explain it to us and tell us what it would look like in practice?
Sure. So, I mean, it's a kind of technical term for a process that's really about thinking and examining how women and men are differently situated in the economy, and different groups of women and men are differently situated as well, because, you know, our approach to gender budgeting would take into account the fact that black women are in a different position to white women, that there's particular issues for disabled women and so on, that there's issues, you know, differences between the outcomes for middle class and working class women. It's not just women as a single group. So recognizing the different situation that women and men are in, and then analyzing how policy is likely to affect them differently. So how we raise money through taxes, how we spend money on public services and social security and so on, in order to develop policies that are more likely to promote equality. So it's a mechanism that's been used around the world. We've certainly been talking about it for a long time. I seem to remember meeting Ed to talk about it probably about 20 years ago.
Yeah, I'm definitely right. When I was in the Treasury, you're completely right, Mary.
Yes. So you know, we've been banging this drum for a long time, and it's, you know, it's been widely adopted in other parts of the world. This isn't something.
Which countries
new.
Do a good job of it?
So it's one of those things that tends to change depending on political circumstances. So it's not like a country will adopt gender-responsive budgeting and that's it forever. Change of government and those sort of policies can disappear. So, for example, Australia was one of the early adopters of gender-responsive budgeting, and then it kind of fell out of fashion, and now people are trying to revive it.
There's the Scandies a lot of work. Must be good.
The Scandies do good work. There's a lot of work in South Africa on gender budgeting. And I mean, there's no one size fits all way of doing it. You know, this isn't a kind of technical fix you can apply. It's really about having an awareness that policy affects women and men differently. So, for example, if you cut income tax, you're more likely to benefit men than women because men pay more income tax. If you cut social security, you're more likely to hit women than men because women receive a higher proportion of their income from social security. So it's thinking those through, but also thinking about unpaid work as well as paid work. So what impact do policy have on the unpaid work that women do?
So we're living in a parallel universe. It's our utopia. It's the Jeffocracy. We appoint you Chancellor. What would a gender-responsive summer statement earlier this week have looked like?
So we've been calling for a care-led recovery. We have a crisis in social care that pre-existed coronavirus, but has obviously been hugely exacerbated by it. We have a crisis in childcare. investment in care, in the care sector, would create more than twice as many. The latest modelling we've done is 2.7 times as many jobs as investment in construction. So it's a way of creating jobs. These jobs are less polluting than other forms of work, so they're greener jobs. And it would reduce the gender employment gap. So we think that, you know, we called on the Chancellor. Unfortunately, he didn't listen to us, but we did call on him to adopt policies for a care-led recovery.
And what's the scale of job creation that you could be talking about, do you think, in the care sector?
If we had the same proportion of people working in the care sector as they do in a number of Scandinavian countries, you'd be talking about over 2 million jobs.
2 million more jobs?
2 million more jobs. Yeah. Wow. And that level of investment. I mean, it's the... And even if you increase the pay of care workers to the same level as construction workers, because, you know, one of the arguments is, well, of course, you create more jobs in care than construction because care workers are so badly paid. Even if you increase that level of pay, you would still create more than twice as many jobs. If we made those investments, it would be beneficial for the economy as well as tackling the crisis in care that we're currently facing.
Marianne Stevenson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
So what did you think?
Well, I mean, it was a phrase that was very familiar to you, but I hadn't quite heard it expressed like this before. But it was about the formal economy versus family economy, and about how childcare falls into the latter when, you know, it's so contingent. People's ability to work and be productive is so contingent on that. And it's clearly not the way we should be thinking about it.
I think it is striking, the end of that conversation with Christine in particular, how absent the conversation this has been. You know, we have talked about social care, and obviously social care has been front of mind for reasons we know about. But it is interesting that childcare, the childcare infrastructure, the weakness of our childcare infrastructure, who's doing care in the home, it's been a relatively hidden subject, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it hasn't really been front and centre.
How do you change that cultural stuff, though? So, we can talk about the state providing more childcare and all the ideas for that we've talked about, but what about, you know, the way men see work in the home? How does that change?
Well, I think there is something interesting, isn't there? We've talked about it before. Father's leave, use it or lose it, changes the attitude of men from the get-go. But, you know, you need big cultural change, but somehow policy change and cultural change seem to have to go together. And that's what the father's leave, all of the experience of father's leave is, that when it was, you know, when it's shared, but not just dedicated to the father, it tends to get taken by the mother. The minute you make it, use it or lose it, the father takes it, and it propels change. I think I'm right in saying that Iceland was one of the laggards in among the sort of Nordic Scandinavian countries on this, and then it sort of made a massive leap forward after it introduced use it or lose it. So I think, policy change need to go together. But I suppose my undertaking from this has got to be a central part of the way we think about a strategic industrial policy.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And for our cheerful person this week, we've invited somebody on who was my actual reason to be cheerful a few weeks ago. He is the host of Nick Cope's podcast on CBeebies. Nick Cope, hello.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. Thank you for keeping my four-year-old hugely entertained, especially during those early weeks of lockdown. I'm not sure that we would have got through it without you. Is that a common response? Are you getting a lot of people getting in touch on Twitter and elsewhere saying you've really saved the day for us here, Nick?
To be honest with you, yes, I have actually. Yeah, it's been really, really lovely. Yeah, a lot of people have been saying, you know, and people are still discovering the show, which is amazing. And they're just saying, you know, this has been, you know, the saviour of their lockdown, and they've been really enjoying the show and sharing it with their friends and whatnot. It's been fantastic. Yeah.
Now, I wondered if for people who haven't seen it, and probably, you know, that includes most people without very small children, if we could just explain what it is, because you had a somewhat storied career as a musician, and then in more recent years, you've started doing children's songs and had a lot of success with that, and now that's on the TV. So can you just explain to people what the Popcast is?
The Popcast is basically, it's me and my whippet Norman, and we appear in these different locations in our rather fancy caravan, and then we're influenced by our environment as to what the song might be, because that's the whole idea, that I've got to come up with this song, put it on the Popcast machine, and send it out into the world for everyone to enjoy. And we get visited by the Popcasters, who are a great bunch of children, one of which is my grandson, Remy. He's turning up on Saturday actually, which will be last Saturday, to Saturday gone, I think.
Grandson, did you say?
Yeah. He doesn't look old enough.
Oh, you're too kind. No, we started early.
So how did you make this transition into children's music? Because I know you. I used to play your band, Candy Skins, on the radio in the early and mid-90s. I tried to see if when Ed was at Oxford, he would have been out to see the Candy Skins, but you didn't really go out, did you, Ed?
Not really, no.
Oh, never mind. You didn't miss much, Ed. Anyway, no, it was... Yeah, I mean, the transition came because the band sort of split up. It came to sort of a very sort of slow, painful ending. And then I spent a bit of time in the wilderness washing dishes and then serving the dishes with food on them to various people around Oxford. And I didn't really touch my guitar because I'd exhausted my creativity. But Amanda, my other half, she started a Montessori childminding business. And I registered as well so I could look after the children as well. And we had two young children. Our oldest was 11 at the time, but we had two younger children as well. So there's lots of children stuff going on. And I started picking up my guitar once we'd done giving the children lunch, the childminding children lunch. Amanda was tidying up and I would entertain them and I would just make up silly little songs and stuff like that. And one of the children, her parents, they ran the Oxford Montessori schools and nurseries, and they said, would I come and fill in the space of their music teacher who'd just left? So I went along. I thought, well, that's quite a nice idea. I'll try and find some ideas of some songs and stuff and just go along and see what it's like. So I did that, and it was somewhat chaotic, as you can imagine, because I hadn't really prepared for it, and you do have to prepare if you're in front of sort of like nursery children. But I went home and had a bit of a light bulb moment, and that was it. I sort of thought, okay, I could start writing some songs. I could possibly, you know, start being creative and make some money out of writing songs again.
And what is the trick? Because what I love about the Popcast and subsequently listening to your albums is a lot of music you end up listening to, if you've got children, is terrible. Anybody who's been exposed to Little Baby Bum will know this. What is the trick to writing children's music that is also good?
I guess what I'm doing, I'm probably thinking about people like yourselves, that you're going to be listening to it. And I, you know, I put everything into that, sort of trying to make them original and clever and not actually original, because the good thing about it is you can sort of take lots of ideas and influences rather than being in the band when you're going to be sort of saying, oh, that you've got a band member saying, oh, that sounds a bit like them, or it sounds like a bit like that band. Or you can just take all these different influences and use them, which is brilliant. You just try and make the best song I possibly can. That's all I try and do, and make it as entertaining as possible.
And how common is this experience, that somebody is watching CBeebies with their kid and thinks, I know that guy from somewhere, I can't quite place him, and does exactly what I did? It was, oh, it's the guy from the Candy Skins. Are you getting a lot of either Candy Skins fans or even contemporaries of yours from the 90s music scene who are sort of rediscovering you?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's all going full circle, which is really cool. Yeah, it was a funny thing on Twitter the other day that a guy put up. He said, it must have been a couple of weeks ago, because I think they were watching the reruns of the Glastonbury, and Kylie Minogue was on, and then she introduced Nick Cave to come and sing with her. And the guy that was watching it, he was the guy that was twittering this message, he said that his wife said, ah, no, not him, he just sings songs about poo.
Now, I would watch Nick Cave's Popcast.
Yeah, exactly.
That is a spin-off I would definitely
What would
enjoy.
I be doing on stage at Glastonbury climbing out? I've got no idea.
Nick, you might be willing to play us a song, yes?
Yeah, I could play a little bit of a song, yeah.
Yeah, let's have a burst.
Okay, I won't play all because this is quite a saga, this song. I think this was on a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. It's all about Hugh the Hedgehog, and he gets stuck on the A32.
Oh no!
But I'll play a little bit about it and leave you sort of on the cliff edge with it.
I really hope it has a happy ending, Nick.
Well, you'll have to go and watch the television programme to find out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want him to be squashed.
Have you heard about Hugh, the hedgehog who got into trouble on the A32? He was out there hunting worms, and he took a wrong turn. Now he can't get across to get home. No, he can't get across to get home. And a kind old man in a transit van pulled over to see what he could do. But Hugh got scared of the man in the van, so he ran and he ran and he ran and he ran towards the A32. And a gang from Milton Keynes on their Silver Dream machines had to brake and swerve and skid. Hugh's mum just looked away. She got down on her knees to pray. She said, "Won't somebody help my prickly kid?" And you know what she did? She said, "Hugh, Hugh, what you gonna do? You gotta get across to get home, son. You gotta get across to get home." So you'll have to watch the rest of this.
Wow. Ed, you're on tenterhooks wanting to know what will happen to Hugh.
I'm on tenterhooks. Never mind Foxy podcast. I'm going to go and watch to find out what
happens. Watch
happened.
The podcast.
You have to. And the song gets worse than that. You really do think you don't know what's going to happen right to the end.
Crumbs.
There you go. You do that, Ed, and wait till you hear about Ralph the Rusty Robot.
Oh, I'm hooked. Yeah. I'm hooked. What ages do you think, Nick? Does it go? Does it sort of?
That's a really good question because the really really tiny babies seem to like it, and I've got a theory that because the parents are enjoying it. That the children are taking, because some of the subject was the Rusty Robot song, for example, is quite intricate. The idea of what the robot's going through, it's all about sort of being thrown out on the scrap heap and all that sort of stuff. But they like all that, and they like the sounds of it and the sound of the words and stuff like that. So I mean, because of the subject matter, I guess anything from zero to for children up to about nine, I reckon.
And I'm 47, and I'm hugely enjoying it. So
thank you very much,
Nick. Thank you so much for being our cheerful person this week.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's been lovely to meet you.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
We are. You got any plans for this week? Anything exciting apart from the tofu recipe?
Well, I was going to say I'm off to the tofu. Are you any views on tofu that would be useful?
I like tofu. Especially if it's marinated in something. I like a firm tofu.
I mean, I've suddenly come to a realization, which I'm not a great tofu fan, but I just somehow, when you look at these recipes, they look really great. Do you know what I mean?
It's because of all the food photography tips and tricks that I told you earlier.
I don't think they do that in the New York Times.
I think
paper
they do.
Of record. All the news that's fit to print. Should we thank our guests?
We should.
I would like to thank Christine Berry and Lucy Stevens and also Marianne Stevenson.
And also thank you to the wonderful Nick Cope for telling us about Nick Cope's podcast. Emma Corsham produces our podcast with research from Joel Pearce and backup from Joe Kenyon and from Zoe Gelber, who does a great job, by the way, of putting together the newsletter. Subscribe to it.
We love the newsletter.
Yeah. Go to cheerfulpodcast.com. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the iDents. Ed Seed composed the music. And the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.